actually raised a question in the house. Can anybody here say that we can keep the faith dimension of this and the political dimension in watertight compartments? Is the moral relativism that we've been practicing here, can we, anybody in this house like to stand up and say, let the terrorists believe what they believe and let Mr. Bush believe, and it's going to work its way out? Like, the way we've been handling this, we may not know what the right way is, but the way we've been handling it is inadequate to deal with this circumstance. And you didn't get much disagreement, particularly on the days immediately after that. That's faded a bit, but there was a window there right after 9/11 when it shook the existing paradigm. There are other international realities that force us to rethink how we've been handling the faith-political interface in this country. There's over 50 member states in the United Nations that profess to be guided in their foreign policy, domestic policy, by the Quran. Constitutionally, they're committed to that direction. Now you talk to people from those countries, are you going to say, well, we don't recognize this integration of yours. We keep them in separate parts. You can't have an intelligent discussion. I've only been to Islamabad once in Pakistan, but when I went there to get a grasp of what was going on, yes, I met with the government people, but I went over to the Islamic International University and spent hours with Islamic scholars saying, I want to understand how your faith commitments affect the things that you're doing. This was right after the Pakistanis were experimenting with doing some nuclear testing. And my question to him was, what difference does it make if the finger on the nuclear trigger is a Hindu nationalist in New Delhi, Islamic statesman in Islamabad, or either a secular or a conservative Christian in Washington? And that was a relevant question. If you went there and didn't get into that, you were missing the boat, and you would in about 50 other states. The long articles that have appeared in the recent years, particularly in Britain and the United States, on the faith positions of Tony Blair and George Bush. We hardly see any articles like that on our political leaders, but in both those countries, it's recognized, whether people like it or not, or agree with it or not, that these people's faith perspective probably is influencing in some way their foreign policy, and at least better talk about it and understand it if you're trying to get a handle on it. The recent U.S. elections, of course, the large number of voters that told the exit pollsters that moral values, whatever that meant to the voter, was a bigger factor in their deciding their vote than either the war in Iraq or the American economy. So what I'm saying is, in many other countries, this faith-political interface is more explicit and having an obvious impact on the policies of those countries and their governments than in our own. But if we have to deal with those countries, it forces us to think this through a little better, at least in relation to them, and for me, it reflects back on Canada itself. A third factor that I think is shaking up the existing paradigm in Ottawa is this demand, much of it from the public, for sort of higher moral standards, or ethical standards at least, in business and in government. The whole Enron, Worldcon scandals, the just ethical lapses of enormous magnitude that hurt millions and millions of employees, shareholders, and people demanding a higher standard of ethical behavior from corporations. As you know, there's a huge, all the business schools across the country are adding ethics courses. You've got to come to grips with that. On the political side, the scandals, the sponsorship scandal, things of that type, forcing more discussion of ethics. We've got to do more in that area. And in this demand for ethics, a demand for more objective standards, that it's not enough just, well, this company thinks this is right and this company thinks that's right. You're not going to get a higher ethical standard of business behavior by coming out of that. People demanding a transparency and the standards that will apply to everybody. It's a search for objectivity. Great arguments about what are those objective standards, but a declining faith in just pure subjectivity and arriving at ethical standards either for governments or for corporations or for governments. So that's forcing some rethinking. Legislation like this, it took our parliament 10 years to get a bill on how to regulate assisted human reproduction and related science. The bill deals with assisted human reproduction related science, which establishes a regulatory body to deal with ultimately assisted human reproduction, but things like stem cell research, like cloning, all this advances in the life sciences. And that was dealt with largely by the Health Committee of the House of Commons, and you couldn't sit on that committee. I sat on it for 2 years. In fact, I hung around Parliament just to sit on that committee when that bill was going through. But the social and ethical and moral issues that that bill raised forced the members of that committee to say, we better take this ethical, moral stuff more seriously than we have. And a lot of the frameworks, the inadequate frameworks we've been using, are just not good enough to handle issues of this kind of complexity, particularly dealing with something as fundamental as life. And then the fourth factor, that all of these are factors that are forcing a rethinking of the faith-political interface in Ottawa, is we're starting to get some pushback from the courts. Now, many politicians blame the courts for judicial activism for getting into all these moral and ethical issues, and I've been among them too. It depends who the Chief Justice is. Chief Justice Lemaire was a believer in judicial activism, and I think he took the court in some places he shouldn't have taken. But the current Chief Justice is not. I think he's more respectful of trying to find a clear line between the people that make the laws, the people that execute the laws, and the people that interpret the laws, and trying to keep the court in the interpretation side. But at this same-sex marriage hearing on the reference to the Supreme Court, it was interesting that several of the justices spent the first morning asking the government lawyers, why are you people foisting this off on us? Why are you sending it here at all? Why don't you define what marriage is? If we do it, you'll accuse us of judicial activism, but you guys won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. That's why you've sent it here. They didn't get a straight answer from the government lawyers, but the real answer was the one I've given to you, that we don't want to touch this stuff. We don't know how to handle this stuff, so shove it off. You guys fix it, and we'll blame the courts for whatever they come up with. But we're starting to get some pushback. And when, if you say informally to some of the judges, we can't handle it, so you guys handle it, they say you better start to learn how to handle it. Which, again, forces maybe a change in this, the way we've been doing things. So, all of this brings me then to this question of how shall we respond to these demands? The way we've been handling the faith, political, the moral, the ethical, political dimension is to, we don't talk about that here. We avoid the issues that will drag us into that, particularly if they'll surface religion. If we got to say something, we'll default to moral relativism. We're being forced to rethink that by events like 9/11, by relations with other states where this interface is much more explicit, by demands for more objective standards, and by pushback from the courts. How do we respond to those demands? And I have just a modest proposal to put before you. I've spoken on this quite a bit across the country and to some of my parliamentary colleagues. And in a way, it's pathetically inadequate because it's so modest. But we're in Canada here, where you've got to want change, you've got to be very modest to not scare anybody off. So my modest proposal is that one of the first things we have to do is legitimate the discussion. Just legitimate the discussion of the spiritual, religious element of our society, of people's views, in the political arena. And my focus has been more on the Parliament of Canada. And how do you legitimate the discussion? Just say it's okay to discuss. We're not talking about coming to some conclusion. I mean, that's be more than modest. We're just talking about legitimating the discussion. It's okay to talk about. It might even be okay in a speech and second reading on a bill to get into the spiritual, religious dimensions of your, if not yourself, your constituents. You're supposed to be there representing your constituents. How can you legitimate discussion? Say it's okay. And I have three things that I use. One is to use the religious polls to demonstrate that the religious spiritual values are part of the political reality. There's more and more of these religion polls are being done. They're done by professional pollsters. Often they're done for academics. I think Dr. George Rolick at Queen's University was one of the first people to really convince the media that these religion polls should be done. Ones that ask people about the most deeply held values, including their religious values, and how strongly they hold them. And these polls, they've been done quite explicitly now for 10, 15 years, but quite at the recent ones, show, 65 to 70% of our people profess to hold deeply held values which are basically religious and expressed in religious terms. When the pollsters ask them for the strength with which they hold these things, pollsters ask these questions, do you hold this view strongly, not so strongly, weakly, not so weakly? Many Canadians hold these religious views, like on the existence of God, more deeply than they hold to their political convictions that we politicians spend 95% of our time talking about. I represent the riding Calgary Southwest in Calgary. It's a very affluent, oil patch driven. You won't find a more materialistic, secular riding in the country than Calgary Southwest. But you ask my constituents, 65 to 70% of them profess to hold these views, and many of them believe more deep, say they hold the belief in the existence of God and his relevance to what they're doing more deeply than they believe in tax reductions. Now in Calgary that is a huge that is a huge statement. You gotta really believe to be in that category. Many of these polls show that 50% of our people, this varies, like I'm giving generalizations, you'd get right down to polling districts on this, but 50% of our people profess to read spiritual, religious literature. Not just occasionally, but regularly. More so than they read political literature, a political party literature, a partisan literature. Far more than read political party literature. Or a third of our people say they pray daily. If you expand it to pray once a year, it goes way up. But if you pin it down today, profess to pray daily. This is part of the reality. I'm not asking whether my political colleagues, I'm not asking whether you agree with this or not, but is it part of the reality? And we're trying to discuss our people's view on some issue or what might inform it, particularly as you get into the moral and ethical sphere, and we're going to ignore all this. It's like discussing geophysics of the globe and saying we're not going to talk about the oceans, we'll talk about everything else, but we'll sort of set that aside. You can't do it and be dealing with reality. So one of the ways is trying to legitimate the discussion is I found helpful with my colleagues, particularly if they're small D Democrats, and there are a few of them in the House, not many, but there's a few that can be moved by your people hold these views. Shouldn't we at least try to understand them? And on occasion, be judicious, be careful, actually express them. So use the polls, which really just are a measure of certain political realities, to try to legitimate the discussion. Now, a second way to legitimate the discussion is to appeal to eminent persons. Suppose your MP is more of an elitist. He said, I don't care what the rabble think on these issues. They're ignorant and uninformed. And I've been told that by, not just by members of Parliament, cabinet ministers. But they will respect some higher elite, so a member of the elite, saying to them, you better pay attention to spiritual things. And one of the concrete examples of that was, I teach part-time at the University of Toronto, one semester a year, and I was going across the campus, and Richard Gwynn, the columnist for the Toronto Star, who's also a fellow at Massey College, where I hang my hat when I'm down there, Richard stops me. He says, you're a religious guy. You'd be interested in this. He said, because Richard's been pretty skeptical about the religious side of things, and particularly the religion-political interface for a long time. Richard wrote that book, you remember, the biography of Trudeau, The Northern Magus. I guess this was 10, 15 years ago. I forget the date of the book. But there's been evidence come to light in recent years that Richard is aware of, and several of his other colleagues about the hidden spirituality of Pierre Trudeau. And in fact, Richard got so exercised about this, he had a conference with a bunch of Trudeau's old cabinet ministers that were still around, a number of academics, to discuss the hidden spirituality of Pierre Trudeau. And what they discovered, or what prompted this, was that, as you know, Trudeau was educated at, among other places, the Collège de Jean Brébeuf in Quebec, which was a Jesuit school. And that there's quite a bit of evidence that he did not abandon his Jesuit, the teachings he got at that school. And in particular, that he got interested in a particular branch of reading several Catholic theologians that were big on Christian personalism. And that there's a pretty direct link between some of his views on the dignity of the person that are captured in a public constitutional policy of this country, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, that go right back to that religiously informed opinion on the dignity and the importance of persons, Christian-based. And what they discussed at this conference was, what was this spirituality of Pierre Trudeau? Of course, about a third of the fellows that came, particularly the political fellows, said, well, no, Trudeau's spirituality was lying in the back of a canoe on the Nahanni River looking at the Northern Lights. That was his spirituality. But the Jesuits that got there said, no. Let us tell you what pounded into Trudeau on spirituality at that formative age, and they got into the Jesuit educational systems based on a set of pedagogical principles worked out in the hundreds. St. Ignatius Loyola, the aim of the exercises, they get into this was still being done in Quebec in the years that Trudeau was at this school. The guy prove this with chapter and verse. The aim of these exercises is to develop in each individual person a close, affectionate, loving friendship with the person of Jesus Christ as the model of human life and inspiration of one's service to others. This was the spirituality that Trudeau was exposed to and had an effect on his and it's interesting, and I'm not making light of this in any way, shape, or form. Some of the second thing they discussed at this conference was why did he find it necessary to bury this so deep? Alan McKechnie, who had been his colleague for 30 years, got up and said, I thought I knew the man. He never said anything about that. Why was it necessary to not say that these beliefs were there? And of course, Trudeau was under the double taboo. He was under the Canadian taboo. We don't talk about this here. But he was also, as a Quebec politician, post a quiet revolution period, when the whole province is throwing off all of this heritage, if he breathed the word about maybe some of this should be preserved, he was in political trouble there. But the effect this has had on some of his Liberal colleagues and other Trudeau admirers is if there was a spiritual dimension to Pierre Trudeau, and if it affected the most significant constitutional and legislative thing he ever did, which was the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, maybe it's okay to at least talk about it. Don't have to go further than that, but it's legitimated the discussion among people that otherwise, I don't think to this day, would even touch this subject. Now, the third way to legitimate the discussion, felt the necessity to be really strong on, is directed to the members of the faith communities. Why is it that the politicians are afraid to open the door, even a crack, to the discussion of religious or spiritual values in the political arena? If you press them on why are you so reluctant, they'll say, because if we open it up a crack, what will come in is a flood of ill-considered statements and positions from well-meaning, faith-oriented people that are tinged with a desire to impose whatever their particular interpretation of reality is on everybody else. If we open the door a crack, that's what'll come in. There won't be reasoned, carefully, graciously expressed statements of faith. It'll be all this other stuff. And it'll be counterproductive. There's no upside in it for us or for the issue or anything else. And because we're so afraid of that, we won't open the door a crack, even if Jesus himself was pounding on the door. We're afraid stiff of it. And so the problem becomes for faith-oriented people, and I'm addressing this mainly to Christian people, but it applies to people of other faith communities, is how to mitigate those fears. And I think, say, coming to the Christian tradition, that Jesus himself was aware of those fears, or aware of those predispositions among his followers to express their faith in a way that was not conducive to getting other people to listen to it or even to tolerate it. And you remember when he sent his gang of disciples out for the first time to do public work, like in his first part of his ministry, was a lot of it was all private. He learned by example, private teaching. But there came a day when he said, I'm going to send you out to the villages around Lake Galilee. And there's a long speech that he gave them. But in that speech is this advice, that you are to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And I can't think of any better advice to faith-oriented people wanting to operate at the faith-political interface than to be wise as serpents. These are interesting analogies. As you know, in the Christian Jewish scriptures, a serpent was the symbol of the devil, the other side. He's telling you, you've got to be smart as the devil. And he said, you've got to be harmless as God. You've got to be non-threatening. And his gang had to be told that. His gang, a week before he was crucified, are going through a Samaritan village, and the Samaritans didn't accept it. So two of his most spiritual disciples says, why don't we burn the place down? We'll have a prayer meeting first, but... And so what did he say? He said, you don't know what spirit you're of. And in fact, what he told them that first time is, if you cannot communicate your faith to people in a non-threatening way, or he told them, don't go to the Samaritans and don't go to the Gentiles. You're not ready to communicate your faith to those people because of your hard attitude. You want to threaten them. And I think the big message to faith communities is, if you want to be taken seriously, if you want to contribute to legitimating the discussion of faith perspectives in the political arena, we've got to learn to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Just one last point on this, and then we'll stop. And some of you have heard me talk on this before. There's been various moral crusades inspired by the Christian faith that involved in legislative action, and perhaps one of the most famous is the campaign of William Wilberforce for the abolition of slavery throughout the British Empire. And I think it's a model of how to conduct a moral crusade. I don't use the crusade, is probably the wrong word. A moral campaign on a moral and ethical issue that has legislative implications. I think it's a model of the wisdom of the serpent, the harmlessness of the dove. A few months ago, I wrote away to the British House of Lords asking them for a copy of that first resolution that Wilberforce used to legitimate the discussion in the House of Lords. You'll recall it in the end of the 18th century in Britain, the House of Lords was the dominant chamber, not the Commons. All but two of Pitt's cabinet came from the Lords. The Lords was the chamber. And, of course, the Lords in those days, although they were not slave owners, and slavery had actually been declared illegal within England itself, most of the Lords profited from the slave trade, certainly on the and slave labor on the colonies. And mentioning slavery on moral ground in that chamber would be like mentioning abortion in our chamber. That all the taboos, we do not talk about that here. Don't you dare raise that. On both sides of the house. Now, Wilberforce is this moral crusader. He's a Christian inspired by his faith that came to believe that slavery was a terrible evil. And I'm sure if he was like many of our moral crusaders, what he wanted to do was ride into the great House of Lords on a white horse, brandishing a resolution that denounced slavery as an abomination from hell and demanding that this place obliterate it from the face of the earth. But his friend, he had a friend, Pitt, same age, young guys, all these guys were in their 20s at this time. And impetuous, you know, when you're 20, you're more impetuous than you are when you're 60. Pitt was wise as a serpent. Pitt didn't particularly share Wilberforce's religious views. He respected them, but he didn't share them. But he agreed with the objective of what Wilberforce was trying to do. and convince them. You got to legitimate the discussion first. You maybe can get to what you want to get to, which is the absolute abolitionist, but you got to make it okay to talk about it here, or you won't get to any. And if you ride in here on the white horse brandishing that resolution that you'd like to bring here, you'll alienate your allies. You got friends in this place. You got guys that know in their gut that there's something wrong with this and we got to deal with it. But if you come in the wrong way, you'll alienate them. And you'll take 20 years to build a coalition to even get your subject back on the order paper. And so the resolution, that's why I wrote to get the... This was before Hansard, incidentally. This was 20 years before Hansard was in the British Parliament. So all these records are done. Of course, in those days, they used to write diaries, and the newspapers used to cover absolutely everything. So actually, they think the record of what was said is as almost as accurate as if you'd had a Hansard. And the little resolution they sent back was... This is the first resolution that legitimated the discussion. It was a 40-year fight to eventually get the law. That this House will, early in the next session, proceed to take into consideration the circumstances of the slave trade. Now talk about an innocuous... Can you imagine what Wilberforce and some of his more zealous friends, they take a look at that and say, what kind of a mealy mouth? That looks Canadian, you know. what kind of a halfway, that this House will next session? This abomination's been around for hundreds of years. We want it done now. What do you mean, defer to next session? You may not even get it on the order paper next session. Take into consideration? We want to abolish this evil, not consider it. The circumstances? It's the evil of it that we want to address. Of the slave trade. We don't want to go after the trade. We want to go after the institution of slavery itself. Not the peripheral thing that feeds it. But Pitt, you want to legitimate the discussion. You come in this way. And I say that resolution embodies the wisdom of the serpent and the non-threateningness of the dove. And the ironic thing about all this was, and some of you know this story, whenever I see historians, I know some of you know it a lot better than I do, but the week that Wilberforce was to actually move the resolution, Wilberforce got sick. Some people say this is an accident, I'd say it's providential. Wilberforce got sick, and who introduced the resolution for him was Pitt himself. Probably gave a more tempered speech than Wilberforce might have given, but it started the process that legitimated dealing with a great evil that ultimately was dealt with by that parliament. So my conclusion is that faith, religion, spirituality, morality, and ethics, and they're not all synonymous, I realize that, are part of the reality of our world. They're part of the political world, they're part of the university world. These attitudes are out there among students, no matter what it's part of the reality. There's a need to legitimate their discussion, at least their discussion, the consideration, frank and honest and open discussion in the political arena and in the parliament. Three ways of doing that is one, to demonstrate that they are part of the political reality, by with my friends, polls cut more ice than almost anything else. Elicit the help of eminent persons for whom we do have respect from things they've done in other areas, not the religious area, but finding out that there's a spiritual component to them can legitimate this with others. And above all, particularly to us that are in the faith communities, learning to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. So that's about all that I'd like to say, and I'd be more than happy to hear your own views on either the validity of trying to legitimate the discussion or the dangers of it. I know it's not an open and shut case. Or any views that you have on how better to legitimate the discussion, I'd certainly be open to that. Or if you've got questions either about the status quo in the Parliament or anything I've said, I'd be more than happy to answer that. So thank you very much.
And I guess I would hear from people from Christians, they would sort of blame the media for sort of the status quo in terms of not discussing faith, particularly in Ottawa. And I was wondering what you thought of that.
Okay, the question here is some particular people from the faith communities blame the media for not allowing this debate to occur. Well, I'd make two observations. I do think that the press gallery in Ottawa, for example, if you did one of these religious polls with just them, my own, and this is all anecdotal because I've never actually done that, I think the percentages would be almost reversed. You'd find, whereas among the public, you got 65% to 70% have these religious views. With the media, it'd be more maybe like 30% or 40%. So there is a sense in which the media can be a filter for these views, or a block, or not sympathetic to them. But I think the remarks I've made with respect to the political arena, the same have to be made in the media, that we've got to legitimate the discussion of these things in the media. It'll be different. How you do that in the media will be different than how we would do it in the political arena. But I think there's a need to legitimate this discussion in the media, and that's an important thing, because if it's not legitimated there, you could even get the discussion going out in the political community, but it won't get through. So I just try to apply this. How do we legitimate the discussion among the media? Yes, no, I think it is a factor. I think, for example, if I was giving a political speech here, I could actually give an actual. I gave a speech in the Lower Mainland here one time on some constitutional thing. I spoke for 45 minutes. I was during the Quebec secession thing. But during the question period, somebody asked a question about abortion, which I answered in a fairly, to my view, a fairly balanced way. The whole Canadian press headline was on that question. Now, you know, if you tried to put it in perspective, at least if it had been perspective, maybe you had to somebody had to report that, but it was hardly the dominant part of the. So it is part of the problem. But I think it requires not just criticism from people outside. I think a discussion with the media. How can it is part of our reality. We can't report it. How can we make it okay to report this in and through the media? Well, yeah, what they did was make, if you read the article, you would have thought I went out to the Lower Mainland to make a speech on abortion. Like, wasn't somebody in the audience. See, this is part of the reality. Somebody was burdened about that and got up and talked about it. I responded to it. If it had been put in context, it would have been okay. But it gave the impression that there was this loony 45-minute discussion on abortion, which was a distortion of the media are a big part of it. But I don't blame the media so much. I just say we've got another task there to legitimate the discussion there.
I'm a student at UBC as well. And I wonder what you would say to those who would, you know, hear your talk about sort of moderate discussion and sort of incremental gains and you'll talk about it, and would say, yeah, but you know, Christians are supposed to be, you know, set apart, and we must not water down our convictions or, you know, be fearful of repercussions. We have to be light of the world. How would you respond to that?
Well, I'd take the whole counsel of Jesus on that, which included this, be wise as serpents and harmless as dove. I'd also say to believers in a practical way, what do you want to do? You want to win an argument or you want to win the war? You want to win a battle? You want to be able to say, I went out on crusade and I sure told them. Of course, none of them agreed with me and we lost the vote 300-1, but boy, I sure felt morally I did my Christian duty. I say to believe, what's the end game here? You want righteousness as you define it to advance or retreat? If that's what you want, that there is advice in. And I point Christians particularly to the example of Jesus. Like he himself was an illustration of this wisdom. And like I take the case of there's no harder issues to handle than sexually related ones at the political faith interface, even in his day. And so you remember that incident where they brought to him a woman taken in adultery. And the guy, the opposition that was trying to knock him down, says, now we got him. So they ask him, you know, the Moses law says that such should be stoned. What do you say? Now we've got him. Either way, if he says stoner, all his talk and compassion and the love of God, what the people are going to think of that? If he says, let her off, well, then you would violate the law of God. And how did he handle that? You know, first of all, he didn't answer right away, which is one of my advice to young Peach, shut up. Sometimes he wrote in the ground. He wrote in the ground. I think it's the only place in the New Testament that talks about Jesus actually writing. And then he answered. And an answer, that's, he says, he that is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone. Now, it's, for one thing, it's a perfect sound bite. You can get that on the national news. But it is shrewd. It is shrewd. Maybe shrewd is an unspiritual word, but it is shrewd politically, and it was shrewd spiritually. And you can't say that he compromised his convictions on that. In fact, he ended up saying that what she'd done was sinful. Also, what he said publicly and what he said privately to her were two different things. And I put this to my Christian friends. I've said this in a lot of churches. What if the Pharisees had brought two guys caught in a homosexual relationship, which is condemned in the Levitical code about three verses down from the one that they were harping on, with the same penalty? And what if we were the ones that were said, now what do you think about this? The law of God says this, and look what we've got here. Would we have had the wisdom to, or the graciousness to answer like he did? So, and you can't say that he was compromising his gospel or his truth or his convictions or the will of his Father, but he found a way to do it that was non-threatening. I just think we have to find those ways too.
Hi, Preston. My name's Blair. I'm an employee here at UBC in the dispatch department. I saw the poster up for your lecture, and I definitely felt that I wanted to come in here to speak. I've followed your career in politics, and commend you for it and thank you for it, for your participation in the political process in Canada. And I guess you brought up so many issues, but you characterized yourself in the camp of the believer early on, so I would just, in getting to my question, say that, you know, I'm in the other camp.
Sure.
But when you characterize, for example, there, winning the war, like I perceive Canada to be a multicultural land with many faiths, many non-believers, secular beliefs, and so what type of war are we seeking to win? Are the Americans winning a domestic war on the home front in terms of generating new believers and taking that war to the global stage? To me, those are some of the issues and problems that faith and politics and that tension and interface kind of bring to light. So, I mean, I respect we're on kind of different sides, but if there's anything to respond to
now. Well, I appreciate you raising that, Blair, and it's one of the challenges that come up when you want expression of, say you want to make it more open for expressions of religious faith in the political arena, but there are a whole variety of perspectives. Well, which ones are you going to give more weight to than others? If you can't give weight to them all and you're just going to make them all mad, is it worth opening the door? And those are all legitimate questions. And there's two things I'd respond to on this. One is that I do find it curious that, like, there are a variety of views on almost every subject that comes up to our parliament. We're not just multidimensional on religion. We're multidimensional on everything. There are very few things on a given day in the parliament that everybody agrees on at all, even what time of day it is. So I've heard arguments about whether it was 5 o'clock or 5 to 5 because someone wanted to adjourn the house before something else came up. And I do find it curious that we say that because there's this variety and the potential of competition among them, and we don't know which one is right, we shut off the discussion altogether, where we would never do that on Medicare or the disagreements on science or the disagreements among professional ethics. I do think the fact there is variety and difference itself should not be grounds for saying we won't talk about that. But the more serious thing that you raise, when I talk about winning the war, I'm not really talking about winning the war for converts or for a particular position. I'm really talking about trying to get to the truth. Like, what is the truth as best we can get to on what's right or wrong? No, but whether you come at that, like you can say, well, I respect all these other perspectives, so you don't really let them engage. Or you can say, maybe, like, we've got to engage and try collectively to come to the best understanding we can. And I actually think that effort is more respectful of other people's religious beliefs than the ones that just says, well, I don't want to get too deeply into it because we may disagree, so let's just fuzzify. And I mentioned I went to Islamabad. I had this 4 or 5 hour discussion with a Dr. Ahmed, that's the head of this school. And he's a very sophisticated Muslim. And I went into everything. What's the Islamic position on the role of women, on thermonuclear war, on jihad, on Israel, on fighting with India, every conceivable thing I could. And on some of the things we agreed, and on many other things we disagreed. But I asked him at the end, I said, you can have two types of discussions with Western-style politicians. You can have it with the liberal, secular politician who A, thinks most of what we've talked about here is nonsense because he doesn't think there's a spiritual reality. And he'll say at the end, this was very nice, Dr. Ahmed, you continue to teach what you teach, and I'll continue to say what I'm saying, and we'll all work out in the end. Or you can have a discussion with me, who's a Christian believer, who thinks there is such a thing as spiritual reality. Like, I know I don't have all the answers, and I don't think you do either. But, you know, would you prefer to have that? And he said to me, I don't think he was flattering me. He said, no, I'd rather have this kind of discussion. Because at least we're agreed that there's some kind of reality. Probably we're both wrong, but at least we agree there's a reality. And he said, if you came in here, and if we were discussing science, and you said, well, I believe water freezes at 10 degrees centigrade, and he believes it freezes at zero. And if I dismissed the difference by saying, well, you know, whatever, you know, somebody's radiator's going to crack, you know. So I guess I hope, maybe I'm over-optimistic, that even where there are these differences, if we could legitimate a certain kind of discussion, in the end it would be better and even respectful of the differences than the way we are doing now. So this is a huge discussion. We could go on all night.
Response to that is, yep, you're saying that two believers can understand each other better than someone, I don't quite see how someone who doesn't acknowledge a specific spiritual world or put a label on it can't have an equally meaningful political.
Yes, yeah, and I didn't mean to exclude that. Yeah, I'd say the same with that person as with Dr. Ahmed. Yeah.
I really enjoyed this talk. I'm actually not even from atheist science or history, so it's very good. But one of the points you talked about in legitimizing the discussion was for those in the community to be, like you said, wise servants and themselves. I'm just wondering, I mean, this kind of information is great. In my guess, you know, the average person on the street in a small town probably hasn't heard this kind of discourse or this discussion, mm-hmm, or thought of these sort of things. But those are probably the ones that are having, you know, writing those letters, or those are the ones the politicians are afraid of opening the door. So has there been any thought on how to reach those people, and the majority of our country?
Yes, yes.
And to discuss with them, you know, what is politics all about? Where are we as Christians? How do we integrate as believers in our community, like our municipal government, our provincial, our federal? Is there any? Because, I mean, you have to come from people who are knowledgeable about those sort of things.
Yeah, what woman's observed and asked is that she says that she's, I think you think there's merit in communicating to the faith communities that this, the necessity of this wisdom and inoffensiveness if you want to be effective, but how do you get that message to millions of believing people? And that's a very good question. I think there needs to be a huge educational effort on this basis, and I think it starts with the religious leaders in the faith communities themselves. Many religious leaders do not understand that their own faith community is a target for politicians if it gets to any kind of prominence. This is a two-way street. The faith communities want to influence the politicians, but if I find there's a church or a synagogue or a mosque in my constituency with over 1,000 people on the weekend with a bigger budget than my political budget, with more prominent people, my political guys want to infiltrate that place. It's imperative for the faith communities themselves to understand more of this political process, which includes this how to conduct themselves at the faith interface. And I think it begs for an educational program on a massive scale with the faith communities. It's something I actually intend to devote a fair amount of time to, but it's a huge task and it's necessary.
Right up front here.
I'm 18, but I'm kind of weird for my age, but what about most of the people in my age group who really don't care about any of them?
Well, okay, this fella's... Well, this is a broader question. You know, it's not just caring about this faith political thing. It's caring about the whole political thing at all. That's the broader thing. Well, I gave a lecture on the democracy deficit at the University of Calgary about a year and a half ago. And a young fellow got up at the end. I'd gone on for 45 minutes about how we could stimulate interest in the democratic process, particularly among the 18 to 22-year-olds who vote less than 20% in the last federal election. And young fellow stood up at the back. He wasn't as polite as you. And he says, "There is nothing you can do or say that would get me involved in the federal politics of this country." And he sat down. So I said, "Okay, my friend, let's play a little thought experiment here." I said, "If I was prime minister," I said, "I tried to get to be prime minister, but didn't quite get there. But if I was prime minister, I would institute conscription. And I would do it to show you that whether you care or not about this, government can reach into your life and screw it up for about 3 years." And just to make sure you got the point, I'd abuse my prime ministerial powers, which has been done, to make sure you and your buddies, because you were sitting with about five guys, spent your 3 years on Baffin Island. And so now he's absorbing this a little bit. So no, I said, now to be fair though, rather than do this unilaterally, first I'd have a referendum on conscription, like Mackenzie King did in the war. And so if you and your buddies don't like this idea, you have to get out there and work your butts off to convince 51% of the public not to go down this road. That's how I'd get you interested in politics. Well, the fellow came up to me. It was a fairly friendly exchange. He knew I was kidding, and he was trying to be provocative. But he came up to me afterwards, and he said, "You know, if somebody did that, I suppose I'd get involved in politics." So I sure being a type. But it's, in a way, it's not directed. But I do think some dramatic things have to be done to try to get the younger people interested in this whole subject, let alone the faith political emphasis. My own view, and I've sat around with many politicians that talk about how are we going to get them interested in this process. I say that's the wrong question. They are interested in certain things. They're just not interested in what we're interested in. They're interested in the environment. They're interested in global issues. They're interested in poverty. And what we've got to figure out is a way to connect this political process to what they are interested in, rather than say they have to become interested in the forms and processes that we... I think that's the direction in which the answer to your question lies, but it probably needs some dramatic thing to to move it along. Okay.
Canada has had a history of sort of going along with the United Nations as such. Now, are you aware of a group that is called the World Federalist Group?
Yes, yeah, so I'm generally aware of world government advocacy groups, yeah, including that one.
Supposedly Kofi Annan has gone to meetings of this organization. I don't know if you were aware of
it. I've heard that, yeah.
Well, the other thing is that the thing about Canada's involvement with the United Nations, I actually have the meeting here in Vancouver on the third Thursday of the month. Unitarian Church. Now, I'm just sort of wondering, it's sort of vague because it's, for example, I emailed the World Federalist Organization about the philosopher Bertrand Russell, because I came across an essay there by Bertrand Russell about 1952-53. That was about world government. And he exposed that if need be, he was for an actual
for an actual totalitarian form of one world government. It's said yeah. very clearly. Okay. Now, I emailed this World Federalist Group, and I said, what were their ties in this law? Russell, and he said he was one of the founders of World Federalist.
What you're asking me, I guess, is just my and this well, anyway, is world my view on world government sort of thing.
Well, I'm just wondering what are your views on the Nine Nations and what you would if you were Prime Minister, what would you have seen?
Okay, well, the question is, what's my views on the United Nations? And I gather you're asking, do I think it's a step in the direction of world government? I've heard these connections and positions. I actually am not that concerned that the UN is ever going to turn into world government. The UN has trouble getting the cars lined up in front of the UN building in New York. I don't want to be derogatory, but I don't see the big threat from the United Nations of as being an instrument of world government. Although I know there's that fear that, and my own view is that the UN has a huge and an important international role to play, particularly in the humanitarian end. But I do not have a lot of confidence in the UN's ability to handle.
To be involved with this World Federalist Organization.
Well, I know there's that theory, but I really don't see the
UN. Yeah.
No, I don't think the UN should be.
They should be involved as an organization as well.
Well, I don't think the UN should be, and I don't think it is really promoting world government.
And you just asked one running out of time.
Okay, yeah. We didn't really answer your question.
Prerogative here. Are you more optimistic after the American election or than you were before? And I'm wondering about the resurrection of conservatism, to use a religious discourse language, in Canada. The Americans re-elected Bush, despite the best advice of the Globe and Mail and the New York Times in their editorializing. What a shock this has been, and they're still recovering, it seems, from this, traumatized by this tremendous surprise. But much of it is put to the explanation that social conservatives, evangelicals, together with Catholics, were the determining factor in this sea change which seems to have come upon American politics incrementally, but now in thinking it's very difficult to see this because it's so up close, but nevertheless it looks very important. So are you more optimistic for social conservatism in Canada after the election?
Well, the main point I'd make on that, Joy, and it's one I make on this discussion when it comes up, even in areas like trade and everything else, is Canada is not the United States. And these people that make, and I don't say that in a pejorative sense, that this country is fundamentally different than the United States. One of the areas where it's different is the existence of Quebec. In this country, there's a constitutional question, if you're a federal politician, that you do not have to deal with in the United States. It's completely different. And I don't think that what happens in the U.S. is necessarily going to go here, or that you can transplant things that go on from the United States. And I have a lot of friends among the Republicans, particularly in the United States, but I don't think you can translate things from the U.S. to here. What I would argue is, though the lesson from the American thing, is there are these deep cultural and moral and spiritual values. And if you pretend they aren't there, and you kid yourself about what they are, like the Democrats attempted to do, you will miss a chunk of that society. And that we shouldn't make that mistake. We should figure out what is the spiritual, cultural, religious, moral root of our own country, and try to make sure that our democratic institutions reflect it. And on the faith community side, the social conservatives in the United States have increased their influence, their visible influence in that system, but that ought to be a sign to the genuine believers among them of the desperate need for them to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves in how they exercise that, because they could blow that out of the water. People recognize now Bush as drawing from that community, being in a sense directed and supported by it. How they conduct themselves will have an awful lot to say about whether the rest of the world or Canada thinks that's a good development or not.
Well, I think we're going to stop it now, and I'd like to have to thank Preston Manning.
Thank you.